Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster Cicely Tiernan with today's Wall Street Journal. President Trump on Sunday said he would sign an executive order aimed at lowering the cost of prescription drugs, looking to implement a policy that ties U.S. drug prices to what other countries pay. Our country will finally be treated fairly, and our citizens' health care costs will be reduced by numbers never even thought of before, Trump posted on Truth Social. On top of everything else, the United States will save trillions of dollars. Trump said he would be instituting a policy known as Most Favored Nation, wherein the U.S. government pays prices for drugs that are tied to the prices paid by other countries. Many other countries pay lower prices for medications because their single-payer healthcare systems negotiate for deals. He didn't specify whether the order would apply to Medicare, Medicaid, or other government programs. He said he would sign the order Monday. Hours before he announced the order, Trump posted, "My next truth will be one of the most important and impactful I have ever issued. Enjoy." Americans often pay higher sticker prices for drugs than people in other countries. For example, the list price for diabetes medication Jardiance was $611 for a 30-day supply last year, according to health research nonprofit KFF, compared with $70 in Switzerland and $35 in Japan. The White House recently waived legislation instituting the Most Favored Nation drug policy for Medicaid, which pharmaceutical executives estimated would cost their industry more than $1 trillion over the next decade and force some companies to withdraw from the insurance program for low-income Americans. Government price setting in any form is bad for American patients, said Alex Shriver, Senior Vice President of Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, a trade association representing major drug companies. At a time when we are facing growing competition from China, policymakers should focus on fixing the flaws in the U.S. system, not importing failed policies from abroad. The idea to peg drug prices to those paid overseas isn't a new one for Trump. His first administration introduced a regulation to do so for certain cancer drugs and others paid for by Medicare. But the effort was struck down by a court on procedural grounds, then abandoned by the Biden administration. Pharmaceutical executives in recent days scrambled to defeat the Medicaid drug pricing proposal in Congress, and the bill paying for Trump's tax cuts is no longer expected to contain it. Trump hinted that the drug industry's pleas had fallen on deaf ears in the White House. The pharmaceutical/drug companies would say for years that it was research and development costs, and that all these costs were and would be, for no reason whatsoever, borne by the suckers of America alone, he wrote on Truth Social. Campaign contributions can do wonders, but not with me and not with the Republican Party. We are going to do the right thing, something that the Democrats have fought for many years. Risk on mood drives Eurozone bond yields higher. Progress in the U.S.-China trade talks over the weekend allows markets to open in a risk-on mood, causing government bond yields in the Eurozone to rise. In early trade, 10-year government bond yields rise by up to 6.5 basis points across the board, with the 10-year bond yield up 5 basis points at 2.604%, according to TradeWeb data. Better risk sentiment usually means lower appetite for safe haven bonds, such as German Bunds, which could drive yields higher. Money market currently priced in 2 interest rate cuts by the European Central Bank for this year, seeing the terminal deposit rate at 1.7%, according to LSEG. German yield curve expected to steepen in risk on mood. Signs of a U.S.-China trade deal back the case for risk on, paving the way for the German bond yield curve to steepen, says Commerce Bank. research Rainer Gunterman in a note. With risk sentiment looking better supported, the steepening bias in bunds is likely to extend, the rates strategist says. German 10-year bund yields are likely to establish a range above 2.5%, despite the benign net supply pattern, he says. In addition, recovering oil prices are also limiting the downside for yields, he says. A steepening of the yield curve means the gap between short and long-dated bonds yields widens. The 10-year bund yield rises 5 basis points to last trade at 2.605%, according to TradeWeb. Everybody's replaceable. The new way bosses talk about workers. Step it up, stop complaining, and make way for AI. CEOs are no longer lauding employees as the talent. Corporate America's long-running war for talent sounds more like a war on the talent these days. Not long ago, bosses routinely praised workers as their most prized asset, so much that some hoarded new hires before having enough for them to do. Today, with a giant question mark hanging over the economy, executives are pulling no punches and saying employees need to work harder, complain less, and be glad they still have jobs. Work-life balance is your problem, Emma Greed, co-founder of the shapewear company Skims and CEO of clothing label Good American, said this month. After recently cutting more than 1,000 jobs, Starbucks CEO Brian Nickel said remaining corporate staff needed to step it up and own whether or not this place grows. JP Morgan CEO Jamian Dimon, in a profanity-laced internal meeting, told employees lamenting a return-to-work mandate that he didn't care. "I've had it with this kind of stuff," he said. "I've been working 7 days a week since COVID, and I come in, and where is everybody else?" The shift in tone marks a shift in power now that companies are shrinking their white-collar staff. With jobs harder to find, many workers are seeing perks disappear and their grievances ignored. The latest episode happened at a contentious all-hands at Uber last month. The company had just changed the requirements to get a month-long paid sabbatical to 8 years of working at the ride-hail giant from 5 years. A decision to require people to work at least 3 instead of 2 days in the office also drew complaints. CEO Dara Khosrowshahi suggested that those unhappy with the changes deal with it. "We recognize some of these changes are going to be unpopular," he said in comments originally reported by CNBC. "This is a risk we decided to take." How much more license do bosses have to talk tough to staff? Take the outrage in 2023 when the head of furniture company MillerKnoll told staffers worried about bonuses to leave Pity City. That comment made in a video call immediately went viral, sparking days of headlines and worker backlash. CEO Andy Owen quickly apologized and said her comments were insensitive. After the Uber town hall, on the other hand, Chief People Officer Nikki Krishnamurthy issued a memo saying the company would speak with some staff for being disrespectful and voicing their displeasure. Workers like Donnie Dunselman, who recently worked for a technology services firm, can sense the new power dynamic. As he applies for new tech jobs, the 47-year-old has noticed that many companies now want applicants to do so many tasks. A position is essentially 3 jobs in one. In his job search, he tries to suss out the culture of a company because he has noticed the tough talk language from CEOs and finds it worrisome. "All you're doing is putting fear in people, and you're not doing to get good results from that," said Dunselman, who lives near Lexington, Kentucky. Behind CEO's more brusque tone lies a disconnect between employees and executives, said Michael McHutchinson, an adjunct professor in applied psychology at New York University and an executive coach. "Some employees are operating like it's still 2021 when they could name their demands because of labor shortages and a surge in worker resignations," he said. Now bosses face a global trade war and sinking consumer confidence and feel they must ask more of employees to survive. This is a matter of pragmatism, McHutchinson said. President Trump and his billionaire advisor Elon Musk have helped set the more aggressive tone in their bid to slash the federal workforce. Everybody's replaceable, as Trump put it shortly after the inauguration. Musk called his February demand that federal workers email what they accomplished that past week a pulse check to prove that they did any work. Advances in generative AI also play a role. Shopify CEO Toby Lycka recently told employees that the e-commerce company won't make new hires unless managers can prove AI isn't capable of doing the same job. Other business leaders are warning their staff to adopt more AI or else. AI is coming for your jobs. Heck, it's coming for my job too. This is a wake-up call. Mitcha Kaufman, CEO of the freelance marketplace Fiverr, wrote in a staff memo last month, "Those who will not wake up and understand the new reality fast are unfortunately doomed." Employees will someday have their moment in the sun again, said Charles A. O'Reilly, a professor of management at Stanford. When the market turns around and job opportunities are plentiful, then CEOs will start to talk more about how important employees are, and employees will take advantage of it, he said. For now, though, some executives say fewer, not more, corporate staff will help them run more efficiently. On Thursday, Match Group, which runs dating apps Hinge and Tinder, became the latest company to say it planned to thin its managerial ranks in sweeping layoffs. About 1 in 5 managers will be cut, said Match's CEO Spencer Raskoff, told investors the company is stepping up efforts to cut costs and rewire the organization to focus on its products. "We lit a fire under the team here," Raskoff said. Hamas says it will release last U.S. hostage from Gaza. The deal to free Idan Alexander is part of a larger effort by the U.S. by Anat Peled, Summer Saeed, and Alexander Ward. Hamas said on Sunday that it will release the last American hostage held in Gaza after discussions with the U.S. over a ceasefire and a deal to allow humanitarian aid to enter the strip. In a statement, Hamas said Israeli-American Idan Alexander will be released as part of the steps aimed at achieving a ceasefire, opening the crossing, and allowing humanitarian aid and relief into our beloved Gaza Strip. It didn't make clear what it would specifically receive in return for Alexander's release. In a post on Truth Social, President Trump wrote, "I am happy to announce that Idan Alexander, an American citizen who has been held hostage since October 2023, is coming home to his family." He added that hopefully this is the first of those final steps necessary to end this brutal conflict. A U.S. official said that they hoped Alexander would be freed within the next 24 hours. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff is expected to travel to Israel on Monday to pick up Alexander, according to the official. The Israeli Prime Minister's office said that Alexander's intended release is a gesture to the Americans without any compensation or conditions. It also said that the U.S. informed Israel that the release is expected to lead to negotiations for the release of additional hostages. According to Israeli policy, negotiations will take place under fire with a commitment to achieving all the war goals, the statement said. The deal to release Alexander is part of a larger effort by the U.S. to get a temporary pause in fighting in place, allow for more hostages to be released, and for Israel to resume allowing humanitarian aid in the enclave, said Arab negotiators. Since a previous ceasefire collapse between Israel and Hamas in March, Israel hasn't allowed the entry of any humanitarian aid into Gaza. Aid groups are warning that the enclave is running dangerously low on food, fuel, and medicine. Some Gazans cheered and celebrated the news, believing it meant an end to the fighting could be close. The deal to free Alexander comes just days before President Trump will take his first trip to the Middle East since being reelected. The U.S. official said the administration wanted to see Alexander released ahead of the trip. His continued detainment also proved a stumbling block in ceasefire negotiations for Gaza, the official added. Alexander's release ahead of Trump's trip comes as the president has grown increasingly frustrated with the slow progress on ending the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. He has made both a priority. He has also issued ultimatums to Hamas, saying they need to release all the hostages or there would be hell to pay. U.S. officials say Trump would prefer to broker a ceasefire diplomatically, but isn't convinced Hamas will release all the hostages without military pressure. Trump has effectively given Israel the green light to advance throughout the whole of Gaza until Hamas changes course and lays down its arms, they say. Trump has prioritized the release of Alexander, 21 years old, who was serving as a soldier along the border with Gaza when he was taken by Hamas on October 7, 2023. But that push has made some in Israel concerned that the U.S. is prioritizing its own citizens over the lives of Israelis. Avian Zangokar, the mother of another Israeli soldier held hostage, said her son Matan is being held with Alexander and blamed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for failing to secure a deal that would release all of the hostages. Some former hostages and families of hostages still being held in Gaza have criticized the government for failing to do one deal that would free all the hostages at once in exchange for an end to the war. If Matan stays in the tunnel alone, Netanyahu is deciding to murder my child instead of releasing all of the hostages, she said. Hamas still holds more than 20 hostages believed to be alive and over 30 more dead bodies, according to Israel. In addition to Alexander, the bodies of four Americans remain in the enclave. Since their son was taken, the Alexander family has dedicated all of their time to lobbying world leaders, especially the Trump administration, to bring their son home. They have Witkoff's personal cell phone number and speak to him daily. Before Trump took office for his second term, right-wing podcaster Ben Shapiro arranged a meeting between the Alexander family and Trump in New York. Trump believed at the time that most of the hostages were dead, and Adi Alexander, Adan's father, informed him that they were actually alive, he told the Wall Street Journal. Trump appeared to have been moved by the meeting, according to Shapiro and Adi Alexander. Whatever I can do, I'll do for them, Trump said on Shapiro's podcast the day after the meeting. But I can see the families just going through hell. It is very, very sad to see. Asian stock markets rise on signs of progress in U.S.-China trade talks. Beijing said both sides agreed to begin a formal negotiation process. By Rani Harai. Asian stock markets rose Monday morning amid signs of progress in U.S.-China trade talks over the weekend. Japan's Nikkei stock average edged 0.2% higher, South Korea's KOSPI rose 0.6%, and Australia's S&P ASX 200 benchmark index added 0.5%. Officials from the U.S. and China concluded the weekend's high-stakes trade talks, with Washington touting progress toward a deal, and Beijing saying that both sides agreed to begin a formal negotiation process. The talks were productive, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said, adding that the U.S. side will share more details Monday. This is a huge positive in the right direction for the markets, and more progress has come out of these Swiss talks than even the bulls were hoping for heading into Friday night, Wedbush analysts said. The details and framework for the U.S.-China trade deal will be key, the Wedbush analysts added. U.S.-China agree on substantial tariff cuts. Washington slashes levies on China to 30%. While Beijing cuts tariffs on U.S. to 10%, with more trade negotiations planned. For Wall Street these days, a lack of bad news counts as good news indeed. A weekend of high-stakes trade talks between the U.S. and Beijing ended without any conclusive deal being announced, but Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on Sunday called the discussions productive and said the U.S. would share more details on Monday. For traders, that was enough. U.S. stock futures jumped Sunday evening, with Dow futures up about 1%. In Japan, the Nikkei 225 index was up 0.5% shortly after the open. Trade between the U.S. and China has practically dried up this year, after President Trump slapped 145% tariffs on Chinese goods and Beijing hit back with 125% duties on American products. The trade war has shaken businesses large and small that depend on China for goods and manufacturing. U.S. households are telling surveys that they have grown much more nervous about the economy. And the move up in futures doesn't necessarily mean Monday will be a red-hot day for stocks. Changes in index futures are easily erased and don't always stick after the opening bell. U.S. suspends bulk of tariffs on Chinese goods, by Brian Schwartz, reporter. The U.S. and China said Monday they have agreed to suspend most of the tariffs on each other's goods while further trade negotiations continue. The U.S. said it would lower its reciprocal tariffs on Chinese goods to 10% from 125%. China said it would lower its tariffs on U.S. goods to 10% from 125%. The U.S. tariffs related to fentanyl and other measures will remain. The two countries said they will establish a mechanism to continue discussions about economic and trade relations. The announcement concludes 2 days of marathon talks in Switzerland at easing tensions over trade between the world's two biggest economies. Since starting his second term, Trump has slapped 145% tariffs on Chinese goods, while Beijing has hit back with 125% duties on imports from the U.S. That has led bilateral trade to nearly dry up, heightening inflationary pressure in the U.S. and threatening the export engine powering Chinese growth. Proposal cutting Medicaid aims for GOP middle ground. House bill is set to include work requirement, but not deeper reduction, some fiscal hawks demanded, by Olivia Beavers and Liz Esley White. House Republicans are releasing their plan to cut Medicaid spending, with the program's defenders in the GOP appearing to win the intra-party clash over how aggressively to change the system that provides health insurance to more than 70 million low-income and disabled people. A section-by-section summary of the bill text, which was viewed by the Wall Street Journal, includes some of the changes Republicans have weighed for Medicaid, including work requirements and more frequent eligibility checks. But it doesn't lower the minimum share the federal government contributes to Medicaid in each state. Cap per person federal spending in the program, or other steps some spending hawks sought. House Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Brett Guthrie, in an interview, cast the changes as slowing down runaway growth in Medicaid rather than as cuts, while warning that the program is going to cost more than $1 trillion a year in the next decade if lawmakers don't rein in spending. The Kentucky Republican acknowledged that Republicans' plans to trim Medicaid spending will likely be more politically palatable to moderates and centrists than to the conservative wing, which wanted a more dramatic winnowing of the program. I think that the people who will have the most difficult time with it would be that it doesn't go far enough, Guthrie said in an office boardroom lined with the committee's policy staffers. We're going to go as far as we can to get 218 votes. The panel was set to release the bill text as soon as Sunday night, ahead of a committee hearing on Tuesday. Guthrie's panel has been charged with finding $880 billion in cuts over a decade, but the tally of the planned reductions crafted by the committee wasn't available. Party leaders want to pass the measure in the House by Memorial Day, along with the rest of President Trump's big, beautiful tax and spending bill. While members of the Energy and Commerce Committee say Guthrie has given everyone on the panel a chance to have input in the bill. The chairman is still predicting a series of negotiations with various factions of the party ahead of final passage. Aside from healthcare, the committee focused heavily on clawing back funding that was directed to clean energy projects as part of President Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, as well as unrelated energy projects, including nixing unspent funds from certain grants and loan programs. The committee is also looking for to auction off wireless spectrum, which Guthrie predicted would bring in $88 billion in revenue. The proposal includes efforts to clamp down on states' use of special tax arrangements to pay their share of Medicaid costs. The Republican plan would freeze at current rates the arrangement known as provider taxes and ban states from establishing new ones. The legislation also seeks to ensure only those who are eligible remain on Medicaid rolls, delaying Biden-era rules on looser eligibility checks and blocking federal funds for Medicaid recipients whose citizenship or immigration status is unverified. The bill would also reduce federal Medicaid payments to states that provide health care coverage for immigrants in the country illegally. The proposal would also require some able-bodied Medicaid recipients, those making more than 100% of the federal poverty level, or $15,650 for a single adult, to pay some of their coverage. The contributions would be capped at $35 a service, or 5% of an individual's income, and wouldn't be required for primary, prenatal, pediatric, or emergency care. The bill includes work requirements, a policy broadly popular across the GOP, though not as strict as some fiscal hawks had hoped. It also aims to stop federal dollars from going to facilities and organizations that provide abortion services, such as Planned Parenthood, a provision some centrist Republicans have tried to block. The bill is set to face unified opposition from congressional Democrats, hospitals, and other groups that depend on Medicaid funding. They say cuts to Medicaid would devastate state budgets, force rural hospitals to close, and leave vulnerable people without coverage. Representative Frank Pallone Jr. of New Jersey, the top Democrat on the Energy and Commerce Committee, said the GOP proposal is designed to take health care away from millions of people, with the money instead being used for tax breaks for the wealthy. Medicaid is one of the largest targets in the broader bill House Republicans are looking to pass by the end of the month, which will fund Trump's top priorities. The GOP is using a process called budget reconciliation that allows lawmakers to bypass the Senate's 60-vote filibuster threshold. While GOP budget hawks are trying to find at least $1.5 trillion in spending cuts over the next decade, with the goal of reaching at least $2 trillion, a block of Republicans have vocally warned that deep reductions in Medicaid coverage will hurt GOP voters who depend on the program and hamper their efforts to keep the House majority in 2026. Trump has promised not to cut Medicaid benefits, but his position on many details has been unclear. Guthrie says his efforts to run through his plan with the president at the White House earlier this month were cut short, given the meeting was running behind schedule. Guthrie did, however, leave the White House meeting with a red Gulf of America hat and the president's challenge coin. The bill would require Medicaid recipients to work, volunteer, or attend school for 80 hours a month. The requirement would apply to most able-bodied adults through age 64 without dependents, and includes exceptions for pregnant women, people with substance use disorders, and others. Not included in the bill, major changes to the minimum share the federal government shoulders for Medicaid, which is also funded by states. Some conservatives had wanted to see the federal government lower the percentage it pays for Medicaid in wealthier states, such as California, or for able-bodied Medicaid recipients who joined under the ACA expansion. Per-person federal spending limits for the Medicaid expansion population, considered by the committee as recently as last week, also aren't included. A Additionally, drug pricing policy the White House embraced as a way to help pay for Trump's tax cuts isn't making it into the bill. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Trump said in a post on Truth Social Sunday night that he would be signing an executive order related to the policy. The White House's proposal, known as Most Favored Nation, would have tied the price Medicaid pays for drugs to those paid by other countries, many of which pay lower prices because their single-payer healthcare systems negotiate for deals. The White House's position startled the drug industry, people familiar with the matter said, triggering a last-minute dash by pharmaceutical lobbyists to get Congress to kill the plan. As grading for equity movement grows, more teachers are pushing back. Method focuses on what students know and allows them to retake tests and turn in assignments late, by Matt Barnum. A principal-turned consultant has built a movement and a business on overturning how teachers have graded for generations. His alternative, grading for equity. Joe Feldman preaches that students should be able to retake tests and redo assignments. There should be no penalties for late work and no grades for homework. No points for good behavior, classroom participation, or perfect attendance either. When you include those in a grade, you're bringing your implicit bias into the grade because not all students learn in that particular way, Feldman told dozens of teachers gathered for a training session in Schenectady, New York, one Wednesday afternoon in March. Students should be graded only on their demonstrated learning of class material, Feldman said. America's grading system has been largely stable for decades, but Feldman has managed to shift many schools' practices in just a few years. And despite the broader Trump-led swell against anything with the word equity in it, Feldman continues to evangelize his approach, and some school leaders keep listening. Schenectady City School District Superintendent Carlos Cotto, whose district paid Feldman's consulting firm $65,000 to train hundreds of teachers in March, isn't deterred by the equity backlash. It's part of the work when you think of education, he said. Grading for equity hasn't escaped political criticism, though. Connecticut legislators, for instance, have questioned a policy in some districts to set minimum grades for assignments at 50 rather than 0, a common feature of equitable grading. Some schools nationwide instituted the practice only to roll back parts of it. Teachers give Feldman's ideas mixed reviews. In Schenectady, some scrolled on their phones during his presentation, while others complained they weren't sure his approach was practical. It remains unclear whether this form of grading is more effective or even more equitable than the traditional way. A must read. Feldman started his career as a teacher in Atlanta in the 1990s and later worked in administrative roles in education. He kept noticing that different teachers had divergent grading practices. Eventually, Feldman went down a rabbit hole on the topic, reading anything he could get his hands on. In 2013, he launched a small consulting firm. For many years, he was its only employee, to work with schools on changing grading practices. Mallory Baquero, then principal of a Los Angeles area middle school, became an early client. She brought him on to shift the school's approach to grading, which she felt was inconsistent and unfair. By the end of the year, teachers were really brought in, Baquero said. In 2018, Feldman laid out his full vision for overhauling grading in a book called Grading for Equity. His big idea is simple in theory, complicated in practice. If the class is geometry, for example, students should get a grade based on how well they know geometry by the end of the course. Nothing more, nothing less, Feldman insists. He argues that disadvantaged students might have home responsibilities, caring for young siblings, an after-school job, that makes it harder to finish homework or turn in assignments on time. When teachers say they need to use grades to encourage students to participate, show up on time, and turn in homework, Feldman responds that this sort of extrinsic motivation doesn't work to improve student learning. Feldman also says that if students do poorly on a test, they should have the chance to retake it to show that they eventually learned the material. Feldman freely acknowledges that he didn't invent this approach entirely. Versions have existed for decades, often known as mastery-based grading. His masterstroke was rebranding and refocusing the concept around equity. Initially, Feldman's book got relatively little notice. I felt like I was throwing a bottle with a message into the ocean and wasn't sure anyone would find it, he wrote later. And then came the spring of 2020. Following the George Floyd protests, educators were looking to address racial disparities in schools. Plus, COVID disrupted students' lives, teachers were reluctant to hand out reams of failing grades. Equitable grading offered an appealing alternative. Avoid giving zeros and allow multiple retakes and late work. The book gained devotees. Teachers gathered in school-sponsored book clubs to dissect each chapter. Professional associations promoted it. School systems adopted its policies. Grading for Equity has now sold nearly 200,000 copies. Feldman became a sought-after consultant and niche celebrity. After his Schenectady talk, a teacher rushed over to ask for a photo with him. The teacher, Rich Wilkinson, read Grading for Equity in Graduate School. "I just fell in love with it," he said. The book helped explain nagging issues with traditional grading, such as how hard it is for students to catch up from a zero grade. It isn't clear exactly how many schools use the equitable grading approach, but it has entered the DNA of many classrooms. New York City, the country's largest school system, has incorporated many of Feldman's principles into its guidance for teachers, including discouraging grades for homework or points off for late work. The school systems of Los Angeles, Boston, San Diego, and Clark County, Nevada, have also promoted equitable grading or its ideas. So have state education departments in Maine, Minnesota, and Oregon. Feldman's consulting work has grown. Now his firm has 7 full-time employees and has worked with roughly 200 schools, districts, and universities. Practical problems. When Jake Johnson, a high school math teacher in Rochester, Minnesota, learned about equitable grading several years ago, he was eager to give it a shot. He quickly ran into practical challenges. When students realized they could retake tests as often as they wanted, they began putting off studying, Johnson said. As the year went on, students fell behind. Rochester made equitable grading mandatory for all teachers in 2020. Many came to resent it, Johnson and others said. Teachers had to grade and regrade assignments and even create new work for students to retake. It was really toxic. It was really bad for student learning, Johnson said. Kent Peckle took over as Rochester superintendent in 2021 and realized he had a problem. Frustration with the district's grading policy. Coincidentally, he had attended graduate school years ago with Feldman, or Joey, as Peckle knew him. Peckle read his old friend's book, but wasn't persuaded. He worried that, without any incentive from grades, many students wouldn't complete homework. Further, he couldn't find any proof in Feldman's book that equitable grading works. People in Rochester kept describing him as a researcher, and it as research, Peckle said. It really was more theory than it was research. Ethan Hutt, a University of North Carolina professor who wrote a book on grading, agrees. There is no firm evidence that grading for equity is better than traditional methods, he said. It is likely some teachers have found success with these practices, Hutt said, but he would be wary of imposing it on everyone. He questions Feldman's claim that traditional grading fails to motivate students. Hutt points to studies showing that students tend to learn more with teachers who are tougher graders. Ultimately, Rochester kept some grading for equity tenants but reversed others in 2023, including unlimited retakes and the ban on grading homework. Other districts have rolled back parts of grading for equity or halted implementation entirely. In Kansas City, Missouri, the district dropped a no-zeros policy after backlash. Arlington, Virginia schools limited retakes to students who scored below 80% on the first try. In Schenectady, where a version of grading for equity has been rolled out district-wide, educators' views differ. High school English teacher Arena Miles said grading used to be stressful and subjective, but Feldman's approach has provided clarity. Yet Christopher Ogunbene, a history teacher at the same school, says equitable grading has eroded students' motivation. He and colleagues are assigning less homework because students aren't likely to do it, he said. Feldman said grading for equity can be, and has been, implemented poorly, especially if imposed without teacher buy-in. Many of the places where there has been substantial backlash, including Rochester, didn't work with his consulting firm. As for the research, Feldman acknowledges the evidence base is nascent. He flips the question on its head. I haven't found any data that shows the current system is better. Trump administration in talks to accept new Air Force One as gift from Qatar. The Qatari government says possible transfer of a plane for temporary use is still under consideration, by Josh Dazzi and Tarini Party. President Trump's administration is in talks with the Qatari government about accepting a luxury Qatari plane for his use as a president and potentially beyond, according to people familiar with the matter. Under the potential arrangement, which is raising legal and ethical concerns, the plane owned by the Qatari royal family would be used as Air Force One while Trump is in office after being retrofitted by a U.S. defense contractor. The U.S. wouldn't pay for the luxury 747-style jumbo jet. It may then be gifted to the Trump Presidential Library for Trump to use after he leaves office, the people said. ABC News earlier reported on the potential of the plane being gifted, and a senior Trump administration official said the president expected the plane to be a gift. The Qatari government, however, said the matter is still under discussion. Reports that the jet is being gifted by Qatar to the United States government during the upcoming visit of President Trump are inaccurate. The possible transfer of an aircraft for temporary use as an Air Force One is currently under consideration between Qatar's Ministry of Defense and the U.S. Department of Defense, but the matter remains under review by their respective legal departments and no decision has been made, said Ali Al-Ansari, Qatar's media attaché to the U.S. Trump is expected to visit Qatar this week. Any gift given by a foreign government is always accepted in full compliance with all applicable laws. President Trump's administration is committed to full transparency, White House spokeswoman Carolyn Leavitt said. The senior administration officials said Qatar had offered the plane as a gift to the Department of Defense, but the gift won't be presented or accepted this week. Administration lawyers reviewed the arrangement with the Qatari government and concluded it was legal, the administration officials said. Democrats and good government groups criticized the pending deal. Nothing says America first like Air Force One brought to you by Qatar, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, D. New York, posted on X. It's not just bribery, it's premium foreign influence with extra legroom. Trump weighed in on True Social, responding to Democrats, who he said insists we pay top dollar for the plane. Anybody can do that. The Dems are world-class losers. Robert Weissman, co-president of watchdog group Public Citizens, said if Trump accepted the jet as a gift, it would violate the U.S. Constitution's Emoluments Clause. That prevents office holders from accepting anything of value from foreign states without permission of Congress. The concern with foreign gifts is that they can sway a president's policy and predilections, and there's little doubt that Qatar wants to gift Trump a palace in the sky for exactly that reason, Weissman said. The pending arrangement follows years of frustration from Trump over the delay on Boeing's work to deliver a new Air Force One. In his first term, Trump commissioned two new presidential planes to replace a pair of aging jets. They are among the world's most complex aircraft, with communications and defensive systems that serve as a command and control platform for the commander-in-chief. Boeing won the $3.9 billion contract and at one point was expected to have the planes ready by last year, but is now years behind schedule and billions of dollars over budget after a series of supplier, engineering, and manufacturing setbacks. Trump spent more than an hour touring a Qatari-owned 747 in West Palm Beach, Florida in February, and said afterward that he might buy a new plane. "I'm not happy with Boeing," he said. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier this month that the U.S. government commissioned L3Harris, a smaller defense contractor, to overhaul a Boeing 747 formerly used by the Qatari government. The Melbourne, Florida-based company is tasked with retrofitting the plane with certain specialized systems to transform the luxury aircraft into a presidential jet. When asked about the plane on April 30th by the Journal, the Qatari government declined to answer questions about whether they were gifting or selling the plane to the United States. "I have no information on the matter," the embassy official said at the time. The Qataris have long run an aggressive influence operation in Washington, throwing pricey dinners and parties for administration and congressional officials, flying congressional staff to Doha, Qatar for Formula One races and other events, and hiring some of the city's priciest lobbyists. That Trump is making one of his first visits as president to Qatar this week is a win for the country, which has faced criticism for its human rights record and has long harbored the leaders of Hamas. The country is economically important to the U.S. for its gas-rich territory and is viewed as a non-NATO ally. How tariffs are crushing small businesses. Nobody in power seems to care. Owners are laying off staff and tapping personal savings, hoping to hold out until a trade deal with China, an 8,752 fee on a $5,649 order by Ruth Simon. The owner of a San Francisco card game company cashed in his money market funds. The founder of a tent maker is looking for investors. A watch and jewelry company in Colorado is holding off on signing a new office lease. And a New Hampshire consumer product company has laid off more than half its staff. Around the country, small businesses that import goods made in China are taking actions, big and small, to try to outlast the current 145% tariff regime on new items from that country. But many are worried that their companies won't survive. "Nobody in power seems to care about small businesses," said Scott Anderson, owner of Five Star North, which works with Chinese manufacturers to make its products ranging from acrylic markers to tiki torches. "At this point, the only option I see is selling out the rest of what we have and shutting our doors." Anderson now has 5 employees, down from 12 at the start of the year. 3 are looking for jobs, and Anderson expects them to leave by the end of the month. The New Hampshire company is also running low on stock and expects to be out of most items in the next few months. Unlike larger companies, small businesses have fewer levers to pull to help them endure the new tariff regime. Most work with a single factory or a handful of suppliers, making switching production to lower tariff countries especially difficult. Smaller margins, thinner cash cushions, and tiny staffs leave them more vulnerable to trade battles and other economic storms. The stakes are high and deeply personal. Finances of small businesses and their owners are often deeply intertwined with the business its owner's largest or only asset. Personal guarantees can also make owners liable for their company's debt. Ronak Trivedi, co-founder of Pietra, an AI-powered e-commerce operations platform, said he has seen a tariff-induced jump in small business closures over the past 4 weeks. "We don't even think the worst is over," he said. "As goods ordered before the policy change now arrive in the U.S. and are subject to new tariffs," Trivedi said, "we are going to see a massive round of layoffs and shutdowns." In April, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce called on the Trump administration to provide an automatic exclusion from the new tariffs for any small business importer. Small businesses do not have the margin or capital reserves to sustain the increased tariffs, nor do they have the ability to quickly modify supply chains, the chamber said. Small Business Majority and Advocacy Group has asked the Office of the United States Trade Representative, the Small Business Administration, and other government agencies to provide resources to help small businesses navigate exemption requests and stay compliant with evolving tariff regulations. There's a lack of support coming out of the SBA, said Sarah Wells, chief executive of Sarah Wells Bags, a Virginia-based seller of breast pump bags and other nursing items. There are no webinars on how to find American manufacturers. No case studies on how to find experts. There are no pathways I have been able to find. SBA spokeswoman Caitlin O'Dea said the agency has endorsed bipartisan plans to double SBA loan limits for small manufacturers. In the coming weeks, it will announce additional programs to match small businesses with American manufacturers, fabricators, and producers, she said. The SBA is working to support the new America First economy with dedicated efforts to help small businesses begin building and sourcing products in America again, O'Dea said. President Trump dismissed calls for small business relief in recent TV interview. They're not going to need it, he said. They're going to make so much money if you build your product here. But small businesses say they don't have the resources to wait for Trump to strike a trade deal with China. Many say they can't find U.S. manufacturers to make the product they sell or who can do it at a price consumers will accept. Some small businesses that manufacture in the U.S. are also struggling because they rely on imported materials. Joe Bissonette, whose company, Skyview Tents, produces tents in Colorado from Chinese fabric, decided not to reorder supplies for a summer restocking. Instead, he will produce fewer tents, 300 instead of a planned 600. As a result, he laid off one worker on his fabrication team of five. Bissonette, who had planned to self-fund his business, is now looking for investors. He plans to give up a stake in the startup in exchange for cash to resupply materials and ride out the tariff storm. Lisa Popowich and John Stein, owners of Think Tank, don't know how big the tariff bill would be until they open their latest United Parcel Service invoice earlier this month. The pair weren't sure whether recent exemptions would lower charges on specific items. The company makes watches, watch bands, and medical alert jewelry in China. The bill showed tariffs as high as 161% per item, adding $8,752 to the $5,649 order. I wanted to throw up, Popowich said. An item that would have cost me $4 2 months ago, now it costs me $7.92. She is now calling wholesale customers to see whether they will agree to pay higher prices. The Colorado company negotiated a new lease for its office space, set to take effect in October, but has yet to sign the agreement. Our margins have evaporated and gone into the negative, Popowich said. Alfred Mai, co-founder of ASM Games, has drawn down his company's credit line and liquidated personal bonds and money market funds to raise cash to cover tariffs on the holiday order he needs to place within the next few weeks. I am essentially paralyzed, said Mai, who started ASM in his living room and is the card game company's only employee. Do I pay the tariffs to get inventory in? Do I run out of inventory? A sales director at Maya Galison's educational toy company, eeboo.com, recently pushed her to bring in more items from the back list to better supply big customers. Galison, who founded the company, tabled the request. She is reluctant to bring in any goods from China now because the company would lose money. I'm 62. I don't want to risk my house in the last inning, she said. It's really rough. If we don't have inventory, we have nothing to sell. We can't make our numbers. This obscure New York court is set to decide fate of Trump's tariffs. The Court of International Trade this week will consider the legality of President Liberation Day Levies by James Finelli. The Trump administration's global tariffs faced their first major legal test this week when a little-known Manhattan court considers one of the president's most sweeping assertions of executive power. A three-judge panel at the Court of International Trade will hear arguments Tuesday on whether to halt the levies, which have unleashed a trade war with the world and threatened to upend the global economy. The federal court, which has nationwide jurisdiction over tariff and trade disputes, operates, for the most part, in obscurity, rarely garnering a mention in major publications and staying off the radar of most attorneys. Most lawyers will get out of law school without knowing that it exists, said Lawrence Friedman, a partner at law firm Barnes Richardson & Colburn, LLP, who specializes in litigation at the court. The court will step into the limelight this week in a lawsuit brought by New York-based wine importer VOS Selections and four other small businesses who say President Trump doesn't have the authority to impose the tariffs. Other challenges have been filed in the court and in federal district courts around the country, but the VOS case is front and center so far. Trump unveiled his Liberation Day tariffs in early April, placing 10% levies on every nation. He imposed even higher rates on many countries he deemed bad actors, but later announced a 90-day pause on those duties. China wasn't included in the moratorium. Instead, Trump ratcheted up its tariffs to 145%. The president invoked the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, a 1970s-era law known as IEEPA, and imposing the sweeping tariffs, saying trade deficits had hobbled the U.S. economy and created a national emergency. The Court of International Trade is no different than any other district court in the U.S., although it has a few quirks. Congress created it in 1980 as a successor to the U.S. Customs Court, which operated for decades in Manhattan when New York City was the busiest harbor for imports in the country. The stout box-shaped glass courthouse is located in an area of lower Manhattan with many government buildings and state and federal courthouses. There are currently 14 judges serving on the court, appointed by six different presidents. Their bread and butter cases involve challenges to trade remedies, aided by addressing foreign companies that engage in unfair practices that hurt domestic producers, such as selling products at less than fair value. Importers also come before the court to challenge duty assessments they believe are incorrect. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.